Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silconet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank, and we are back together after your sojourn in Virginia.
I'm back, baby. I'm back.
And we are recording, of course, from Frank's office overlooking the Firth of Forth and sunny blue skies here in Edinburgh. So it's good to have you back with you, Frank.
It's great to be back, David.
This has been a weird week we've had in the past.
No, stop. I'm going to hijack things.
Okay.
Our devoted listeners will know that David normally does the introduction, but I want to hijack this. Initially, I wanted this as my last drop, but think of it as my first drop.
First drop, okay.
I want to congratulate you, David.
For what?
Well, I want to congratulate you, and some of our listeners will know if you follow us on Twitter, that David is a finalist for the Lincoln Book Prize.
Yes.
And the Lincoln Book Prize is sponsored by the Gilda Lerman Institute for American History.
It is.
And it goes to basically the top book of the year in the Civil War period.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
This is a big deal.
Or
to quote Joe Biden, it's a BFD. It's a big deal, David. And I'm really pleased.
I was very pleased, too. So I went to sleep Friday night. I guess they announced it Friday night in the U.S., but I sort of had gone to sleep around 11 o'clock UT time. And that was kind of an ugly day. It was Brexit day, and things weren't going so well in the Senate trial, and I wasn't in a great mood and woke up Saturday morning and all these kinds of congratulatory emails. So I was very, very happy about that.
No, congratulations. So just say a few words about it. Tell us about the prize. Tell us how many finalists there are.
So the prize is
toot your own horn.
Oh, okay. So the prize is about 30 years old, I think. It's sponsored by Gilda Lehrman, which sponsors a number of great American history programs. I know you've been involved with Gilda Lehrman in the past. And this is a prize that goes to the best book about either Lincoln or the Civil War soldier or the Civil War era. And it's been given to some really amazing, if you look at the list of winners over the past 30 years, it's really a sort of amazing crop of books. Usually they nominate sort of three finalists, and then they announce the winner on Lincoln's birthday, which is February 12th, so next Wednesday. This year they did slightly differently. They nominated 8 finalists for reasons that haven't become clear to me. We'll find out. It's sort of like the Oscars. You have the nominations announced publicly, and then the eventual winner announced next week. And
so then are you the Irishman or are you 1917? Well, we'll find out.
I mean, the other list of books are really just an amazing range and quality of books that are the other nominees. And Eric Foner is in one of them. And if you had told me 20 years ago I'd be vying with Eric Foner for a book prize, I would have thought you were pulling my leg or something.
Well, congratulations! Thank you.
I'm deeply honored. And there's a fancy dinner I get to go to, so I have to buy a new wardrobe because people listening probably think I dress in a very glamorous and fashionable way, but I do not.
Well, people who follow David's Twitter feed will know it must have been almost a year or two ago when you said, I've only ever owned one suit. Why do I need a suit? My response was, you're an adult. But now you know the answer to your own question.
Now we see. Well, that's, and I'll have to buy a suit. Yeah, all right.
Anyway, so when is the dinner?
The award gets announced on Lincoln's birthday, but the dinner is in April. I think it's April 20-something. And there's a big thing. It's at the Union Club in New York, so they invite all the finalists to come, whether, including the person who obviously gets the prize. And you get a fancy Lincoln statue if you get the prize and a decent chunk of money, too. But the fancy dinner I'm looking forward to, regardless of whether I win or not.
Well, congratulations, David. I'm really pleased.
I'm very excited about it, too. All right.
But the last week,
yes,
which is what we're thinking about.
The good news of the week is me getting finalists from Lincoln Prize. The rest of the week is kind of...
So if we think about what's happened, so we're recording this at lunchtime on Friday in Edinburgh. Since last Friday we Brexited, or at least kind of Brexit, officially Brexit occurred.
Yes.
It's going to unfold over the next
I heard
year.
Some fireworks at 11 o'clock here in Edinburgh time.
Did you?
The, interesting. Official, moment or whatever it is. Yeah.
So there was Brexit on Friday, the Super Bowl was on Sunday, which may have marked the end of the Patriots dynasty. The less said about that, the better. on Monday, the Iowa caucuses were held, and we'll get to that in a second. On Tuesday, President Trump held his State of the Union address. On Wednesday, President Trump was acquitted in the impeachment trial. And yesterday, he gave a rather interesting performance. Was it yesterday?
It was yesterday.
Celebrating his, the days of Run Together, celebrating his acquittal. And what we thought we'd do today is we're going to be slightly different than our usual format. So instead of taking a particular theme and attempting to historicize it, we're going to attempt to reflect on these events and provide some historical context, although frankly, if I'm totally honest, sorry, excluding the Super Bowl and Brexit, we're going to start on Monday, really, excluding those things. We're going to some extent, I think we've reached a point where a lot of these things don't have historical precedent, so it may be more a kind of reflection on this, just the series of events that have happened this week, and trying to provide some context.
The juxtaposition of those three things within a three-day period is really unusual. You know, each of these would be the news item of the week in most other weeks.
Yes, well, if the age of Trump has taught us anything, it's that the news cycle just happens much faster than it used to. We'll get to the impeachment. I'm not sure the acquittal will necessarily give him the bounce he thinks because, you know, November's a long way away in the way that the news cycles have been.
Yeah, that's a million years in the new chronology, yes. Yeah.
So we start with Monday night in the Iowa caucuses. Just by way of background, I'll say I boarded my flight. So I flew home. I traveled all day Monday, and I boarded my flight in Newark, flying back to Edinburgh Monday evening. I obviously was offline for my flight, but landed Tuesday morning here in Edinburgh, turned my phone on very quickly, opened both Twitter and the New York Times app, looking for the results of the Iowa caucuses, and there weren't any.
Yeah.
And so that was a little bit of a surprise.
So for people who aren't, you know, longtime Iowa caucus watchers, you know, the way this, it's a very strange procedure what they do in Iowa, where instead of having people vote for candidates, you meet in these caucuses where you have people being sort of allocated, you know, choosing which candidates they prefer, and then candidates who are not popular get dropped out, and those people get reallocated depending on their sort of second and third preferences. And it's this very, the way it's usually advertised and the way it's usually reported is this very sort of quaint, middle of America, quirky voting phenomenon. But usually we know the results by 10 o'clock at night, and we sort of then, the next day is two or three of the candidates dropping out because they didn't do well enough in the Iowa caucuses to be a viable candidate.
And somebody gets a boost.
And, you know, so like Barack Obama did very well in Iowa, and so that helped, you know, legitimize him as a candidate, and obviously we know where that went. Sometimes people don't do so well in Iowa, but then they come back later. We can think about Bill Clinton, that happened to him. But what happened on Monday was not part of the script. You know, in terms of they had various problems with reporting the results and tabulating the results and figuring out, they had an app that didn't work the way it was supposed to, and they tried to phone in the results, and the phone lines were jammed and all the kinds of things. And I think even as we're recording this, we still don't have 100% of the results from the caucuses.
As of this morning when I was walking in and listening to the news, I think it was 97% was reported. And interestingly, it's been neck and neck, Pete Buttigieg, Mayor Pete, and Bernie Sanders for the past couple of days since the results have started trickling out. Mayor Pete declared himself the winner on Monday night, which was interesting. That was a move out of the kind of Bill Clinton playbook. It now appears that he might have just been edged. More confusing still because they count both the delegates and the popular vote.
Yes.
When they produce the results. And at one point, I'm struggling to keep this straight, Mayor Pete was winning in one category and Bernie was winning in the other. Yeah. It now appears that Bernie Sanders has just edged out Mayor Pete in both categories. And so Bernie Sanders won the Iowa caucuses. Buttigieg effectively won too because he had to do very well in Iowa, and it's essentially a statistical tie. The big loser would seem to be Joe Biden.
Yes.
Although Joe Biden didn't, is perhaps not suffering as the loser would normally suffer because because the volume of news this week and because the results have been so elongated. Everybody moved on to New Hampshire as they always do Monday night. You know, they fly directly from Des Moines to New Hampshire. And the campaign continued there. So we didn't get the winnowing of the field we normally get because we didn't get clear results.
Oh, and we also had some winnowing of the field before Iowa, which still usually means that usually Iowa is the point at which people start to drop out, and we had some winnowing a month ago.
So, David, you did a good job describing, well, it's very hard to describe how this caucus system works, but the case for Iowa is this sort of exercise in local democracy by people in the heartland of the country. It's a very Norman Rockwell kind of scene with people appearing.
And you're supposed to persuade your neighbor to vote for a different candidate.
It's kind of consensual and it's
19th century democracy
right,
kind of thing.
Right. The caucus system has always been awkward. It's difficult for outsiders to understand. There are limitations to it as far as accessibility for people and people who work can't go. People who are disabled can't go, often have difficulties attending. It's all, you have to make a time commitment to go.
Yes.
And of course, Iowa's not representative of the nation.
You can't vote absentee.
Right. So there are all kinds of limitations. Is this the end of the Iowa caucuses? I was interested in looking at the history of this. They only go back to 1972.
As in the current system.
Yeah, in the current incarnation. And that's not very long. However, they've been very influential. The only candidate who's ever gone on to win the nomination who hasn't won in either Iowa or New Hampshire is Bill Clinton in 1992. So they do serve this important, they have served this important kind of gatekeeping role along with the New Hampshire primary. Yeah. But is this the end of Iowa?
I hope so. I think this is honestly a stupid system.
I agree.
For multiple reasons. I think one, as a process, for all the reasons you outlined, it discriminates against a whole cast of voters, and so there's a good reason in terms of accessibility. Iowa is not representative of much of anything except for Iowa, and so it's not a very diverse population, and if you take a non-diverse population and then winnow it even further by the ways in which the caucus success is inaccessible. I really like to see this, done away with. And we talked about the primaries a couple episodes ago. I mean, the point you mentioned about it being, we tend to think of Iowa as traditionally being first, but as you point out, it's not actually been first all that long. It's been in, your lifetime that happened. And that happened as a consequence of what happened in 1968 when the Democratic convention, as a consequence of a variety of factors, ended up in chaos, and they wanted to have a structure in place to prevent that from happening again. And so it's not actually as seeped in tradition as some people like to make it out to be. People have asked, why does Iowa have a caucus and not a primary like most other states do? Iowa actually had a primary at one point, but then they did away with it because they thought a caucus would be cheaper. So it wasn't actually for traditional reasons, it was just for financial reasons. They went from having a caucus, which is a 19th century model.
Well, those are hearty Midwestern values, David.
lots of all the other Midwestern states seem to be able to have a primary. And some of the earliest places to have primaries were Midwestern states, and so I don't think there's a... I think the ways in which Iowa has dominated the landscape in terms of people going to the Iowa State Fair every year and camping out, and I don't think that's actually healthy for picking the best candidate. And in terms of having a diverse pool of candidates in the, especially the Democratic primary, because the Democratic Party nationally is a very diverse party, and you don't see that in Iowa.
Yes, I mean, I agree with you completely.
Actually, part of the reason why Obama was boosted so much by his victory in Iowa in 2008 was in part because, for him as an African American to win in a very white state, that actually sort of showed the rest of the country that he could win. But I think that's the sort of exception that proves the rule, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And we talked about primaries a few weeks ago, so we don't really have to belabor this now. The one virtue of Iowa is because it's got a relatively small population, it's just slightly over 3 million. And the electorate is much smaller still, or the Democratic electorate in particular, it requires a level of retail politics that tests candidates. So having a small state go first makes sense. Whether it should be Iowa is debatable now. And it seems to me this is the end of the Iowa caucuses, because as the cliche goes and as the meme goes, you had one job.
Yes.
And the Iowa Democratic Party didn't do its jobs. And I feel a great deal of sympathy, actually, when you think about the number of volunteers and campaign workers who've been working in Iowa for the past year for the various candidates. And the whole point was to get that
boost
from, Tuesday morning, and they didn't get it.
Yeah.
And, I've tried to stay away from the kind of conspiratorial-minded Bernie bros on Twitter and social media, but I could imagine, I have seen a little bit of this where they're saying, well, the Democratic establishment doesn't want Bernie, so they denied him this victory. I don't think that's the case, but that it certainly looks that way.
Well, I think running elections is hard. Running primaries has an extra weird level of complexity to it, just because of the structure of it. You know, and the people who are in charge of running elections, they only get a chance to actually run elections, you know, every other year, really, and things like, you know, these caucuses every 4 years, you know, which doesn't give you a whole lot of time to sort of test the system to see whether it works well. And clearly the system here didn't work well. In the scope of American electoral problems, where would you put this in the annals of elections not being run the way they're supposed to?
Oh, I think this is actually not that significant in the sense that we had a general election here in the UK not long ago, and one of the things that did strike me as I was express some frustration about Iowa on social media, but you know, in the UK, it's not uncommon to wait a day or two to get the final results in, and that would be up this because they're counting the votes, and to some extent, we expect everything immediately.
Yes.
And if we'd known it was going to take a couple of days to get the results, that would have changed the equation. But and I don't think the results are invalid. It seems to me the results are accurate. I think theoretically the purpose of Iowa is to allocate Iowa's delegates to the Democratic convention. They've done that successfully. I don't think there was any chicanery around the vote, although people have suggested that because we distrust voting now. I don't think it's Florida in 2000. Now, Florida in 2000 was important because it determined who the president of the United States was. I think this was very frustrating for the Buttigieg campaign, for the Sanders campaign. I think it was probably a bit of a get-out-of-jail-free card for the Biden campaign because they did so poorly in Iowa, but they didn't necessarily suffer as much as they would have. Having said that, given the State of the Union and the impeachment as well, all the other things we're about to talk about that were going on this week, I'm not sure. Iowa never gained the traction it would have in a normal, and I'm using inverted commas here, a normal election year anyway because of the impeachment trial, I think.
I think that's right, and especially since a lot of the people who were running were actually at the trial for the 2 weeks leading up to the caucuses. On the other hand, I think I'm really worried about the coming election and the kind of trust Americans have that the election's that their vote's going to count and that the results are ones they can trust.
I think you put your finger on that. So I wouldn't necessarily put it in the top 10 list of election cock-ups in American history and see where it fits. I think you're right. The damage done is arises from that. There's already a great deal of cynicism over whether we can trust the electoral system in the United States in the wake of the 2016 result, and more importantly, everything we've learned since then about foreign interference and everything else. And this is just, for people who don't follow it as closely as you and I do, for example, and our listeners do, this will be just another headline about elections not working. And one thing that I found interesting and worrying as somebody who does not want to say, I think it's okay for me to say I don't want to see President Trump reelected.
Yeah, I think we gathered that.
The turnout wasn't great. It was okay. So I think 167,000 people voted in the caucuses. But the benchmark now, the high water mark in Iowa was 2008 when 240,000 people turned out to vote. So that was when President Obama, or then candidate Obama, really did expand the electorate and brought new people out. The vote in Iowa this year was roughly akin to what it was 4 years ago. And I think that should be worried
for the Democrats. Primary.
Yeah, for the Democratic primary, sorry. Yes, for the Democratic primary.
Or Democrat caucus, I guess.
And I think that should be a little bit worrying for the Democrats more generally. And to the extent that this fiasco in Iowa depresses enthusiasm, I mean, and depresses people's faith in the system, I think that's a word. I spent a lot of, you know, my last month in Virginia, I asked almost everybody I met socially what they thought of the upcoming election. And most of these people...
That's a good way to make friends in Virginia.
Well, you know, I have a lot of friends in Virginia. but the number of people, I mean, I only spoke to one or two Trump supporters, but among those who were not Trump supporters, the amount of sort of resignation and despondency on display was worrying. People saying, well, he's going to win again. Almost. Now, I think that's a correction to some extent, because 4 years ago, we thought it was impossible for him to win. And I don't think the situation is as rosy for him as a lot of people seem to believe. But that was very interesting. So I think when you add these things together, these are worrying signs.
I mean, and they're building on, I think, 20 years of people being concerned about elections. Because one of the things I think that had happened in the 20th century is that most elections, at least at the presidential level, were not particularly close, with the exception maybe of 1960. There's a lot of blowouts in presidential elections. So people were confident that the person who occupied the office is the person who won the election. You know, what we've had since 2000 is we've had, you know, in some ways this sort of minority electoral, you know, minority popular vote, electoral college victory a couple times. We've had obviously the Florida election. We've had all the accusations about foreign intervention in a variety of ways. In the last election and potentially in the next election. So it is really troubling. And obviously Trump's claim that there were 3 million illegal votes cast only sort of adds fuel to the fire in terms of...
Well, a big part of Trump's message and Trumpism is about you can't trust any of these institutions anyway. They're all corrupt. They're all flawed. And the fiasco in Iowa does feed that. Again, I don't think in terms of its long-term consequences for the Democratic contest, it necessarily matters.
All right. So, speaking of institutions and not trusting, let's talk about the State of the Union.
Yes. Well, the interesting thing about the State of the Union, or this current, we had an episode on the State of the Union, didn't we?
So years and well, a couple years ago, yes.
Yeah, we don't need to rehearse this necessarily to that extent. One thing that's interesting, on one hand, President Trump was feeling pretty bullish because he was about to be acquitted in his impeachment trial, and he's up for re-election, and this was very much a re-election. He was basically holding one of his election rallies
at the State of the Union.
At the State of the Union address. I would say a couple of things about that. One is, and this is very interesting to me, and this is the kind of thing he responds to, the ratings for his State of the Union addresses have declined year on year. So the first one had, and I don't have the numbers in hand, but the first one was had a huge rating. The second one was less so, and this week's was even less so. And to some extent, this guy's a television performer. This guy responds to ratings. And what do you do, especially when you're in reality TV, when your ratings are going down? You act crazier. Now, I don't think it's that calculated. I actually think he's impaired. I think he's. I don't think he's necessarily deciding to act crazier to keep up ratings. But the shtick may not be working to the same extent that it used to.
Yeah.
So that's one observation I make. The other is the State of the Union as a... as an institution has been in decline for a long time. I mean, because, and on both sides, it's been, it becomes this piece of performance art where you, you know, you have people stand up who have done worthy things or not, as the case may be. You know, there are always soldiers and so on, and it's become, it has become a bit of a variety show almost. I think we should almost go back to Jefferson just sending his annual report to be read by the clerk of the Senate.
And so, I mean, one of the, you know, the Constitution says the president from time to time has to, you know,
we'll make an annual report
on the State of the Union and recommend what things he thinks are necessary to whatever, right? And I think you're right to point out for most of American history, this was a written report the president sent over, and it's, if you've read them, super dull.
Yes.
You know, the president writes a bit, the Secretary of the Treasury writes a bit, the Secretary of Agriculture writes a bit, you know, and there's not, you know, it really is a sort of, you know,
annual report. Our boss, Ewan Cameron, the head of the School of History, Classics, and Archaeology, has to produce a school report every year around this time. He sends it around to the various heads of departments and sections that make up the school. And it's a... This isn't a comment. Ewan has to... There's a form he has to adhere to. Mm. It's pretty dull reading. That's the state of the... That's the content of the State of the Union, or what it used to be.
Yes. Now, it changed with Woodrow Wilson because he wanted to give a lecture.
He always did.
Yeah, he's a college professor, so I mean, it fits. But one of the things I think that's happened, you know, the idea of signaling out people in the audience, that model of how the State of the Union runs has become more and more prominent in the past 30 years. I mean, yep. You remember sort of George Herbert Walker Bush with 1,000 points of light. And he points out that, you know, the child who does this and the veteran who does that and the disabled person who does something else, you know, and it's about, you know. But there it was not so much. I mean, obviously, it's a politician giving a speech, so all these things are partisan. But there was a period in the 20th century in which the State of the Union address wasn't as hyper-partisan as it has become. That, you know, the half of the speech would be platitudes about America being great, and everybody would stand up and cheer, regardless of what party they were, and then half of it would be a laundry list of legislation he wants passed.
A bit like the Queen's speech in the British
right.
system.
Yeah, and people would stand up or nod and applaud. But it was clearly a very different kind of public speaking than a political rally. And it's become more and more partisan. You know, in some ways it's supposed to be a bipartisan exercise. It's about the State of the Union, the what we have in common, rather than here's what I'm going to do. It was always about, at least on some level, about the union and not about the person giving the speech.
Yes.
And Trump, and obviously there are antecedents to this, has made it more about him, because everything for him is about him, but it's made it about him rather than the nation as a whole. You know, and the thing with giving Rush Limbaugh the Presidential Medal of Freedom during the speech, I mean, in some ways that is a descendant of the 1,000 points of light. On the other hand, it's a very different kind of explicitly partisan act in the middle of this event than anything, you know, like that was.
You're looking at me like, I don't know how to tell you to put it in the form of a question.
Well, I'm just wondering.
I think that's true, but I think... In thinking about this episode, thinking about all these events, one of the things that's really struck me is the degree to which a lot of institutions, whether it be the Iowa caucuses or the State of the Union or the United States Senate,
exactly.
have been found wanting.
Yes.
And it seems to me, it was interesting to me that the Iowa caucuses in their current form started in 1972. Because reflecting on this as a historian, I wonder if in the aftermath of Watergate, and I realize that wasn't the aftermath of Watergate, but it's the Watergate era.
Yes.
We in the United States got a new political settlement and a new understanding of the way things were going to operate and a kind of revitalization of certain institutions. And what we've seen this week and what we've seen in recent years is the end. I'm not quite ready to articulate this argument. It's been knocking around in my head for the past couple of days. We're seeing those institutions come up short in different ways. We have seen that in the past couple of years. This isn't strictly a partisan thing. I think it's bigger than that. What gives me hope is that we may see a revitalization and we may see a revisit. We may revisit these institutions and in 5 or 10 years, they're going to have very different forms. But I think what we saw the other night was how useless the State of the Union has become.
Yes.
So I'm not sure 10 years from now it will exist in the same way. Because the State of the Union as dog and pony show, and Trump was, you know, has reduced it to the absurd, but Obama did the same thing. You know, in terms of highlighting people.
Yes.
And then you got the lack of civility during it with him being told he lied. This has been going bad for a while.
Yes.
And I wonder if we haven't hit, well, I always think we've hit rock bottom and then we have further to go. I think we're seeing that some of these institutions need reform. Well, and this is more evidence of that.
Well, I'm wondering at what point we end up with a situation where the opposition party stops going.
Yes.
Because there were a handful of Democrats that didn't go. The Chief Justice didn't go, which is probably a good idea, considering he was still presiding over the impeachment trial while earlier that day.
Right,
in the
and
same
Nancy
chamber.
Pelosi memorably tore up the speech at the end of it.
But you can imagine a scenario, if this continues in this trajectory, in which it's the president giving an address just to his own party, and it really actually is just a rally, and there isn't the, bifurcated nature. I don't know, but it seems like it's in that direction.
Yes, I think you're right. And, particularly if you have a situation where the president and both houses of Congress are held by different parties, in which case, let's suppose the president is giving a State of the Union address and he or she is only speaking to the minority of the Senate, the minority of the House of Representatives. That might be the kind of moment at which we say, okay, what is this?
This, right. And increasingly, one of the things I've noticed is that in the 20th century, there were often people from the courts and from the military who would show up in a nonpartisan basis at the State of the Union as a sort of symbolic gesture about the sort of national unity that's supposed to be embodied there. Half of the court didn't show up to the State of the Union address, and those who did were the ones who, for the most part, were apparently Trump supporters, and, you know... Yeah, it seems like a very different animal than what I remember from, the 80s and 90s. And
yes, but I guess what I would add is this has been a long time coming.
Oh, to be sure.
And so I think the State of the Union is revealing itself to be not fit for purpose. And
yes.
Okay, given so the constitutional requirement is not to hold this thing.
It's a very vague, right? It's about from time to time. It could be every whenever, right?
Yeah, if Trump wanted, he could release a series of Twitter thread as his State of the Union address. That might be better than what we got.
At least then we can mute him. All right. Yeah. So right now we're going to do away with the Iowa caucuses. We're going to do away with the State of the Union. We are dismantling the late 20th century political structure and standards piece by piece. Let's go to impeachment. We had this sort of trial that lasted for a couple of weeks. If you want to call it a trial, that ended with Trump's acquittal on Wednesday. How does this, now that we've seen this whole thing play out, what's your sort of reflections on
it? Well, I want to ask you, Dave, because I think of the two of us tend to be a little more pessimistic about these things than I am.
Right now the world is on fire. But,
okay. Right. I was because my own response, I was disappointed.
Mm.
Of course I was disappointed. But then I tried to take a step back and say, well, we knew this was going to be the outcome. That was always, the chances of being removed were always infinitesimal.
Yes.
Now, I thought that impeachment was worth doing for the following reasons. I think, most importantly, as a historian, I think we need to get as much of this down on the record as we possibly can. And so I think it was useful as an exercise. I also think, from a partisan standpoint, it might be useful because the people who voted to acquit President Trump are going to have to stand by those votes in both the House and Senate as more and more information comes out, as inevitably it will. And we've already seen more information leaking out, whether it's Lev Parnas's dinner tape or whatever. So it seems likely more information is going to come out. So I think it serves historians a useful role. We need to get things on the record. It was also the right thing to do, but it might have served a political role. On the other hand, in the short term, it seems to have been a political boost for President Trump. I'm less persuaded by that. The thing that bothers me again is the institutional one, because I think what we saw was a confirmation of what's been going on a long time, but the Senate completely abdicating its responsibility. Right. And its oversight role, because we're now in a situation. Now, one thing that worries me is I think we've already seen hints of this coming from some senators who voted to acquit President Trump. Oh, well, if it's President Biden, we're going to impeach him on day one. So I think impeachment's going to become a more frequently resorted to political weapon. But what we've also seen in terms of and we've talked about presidential power and the rise of the imperial presidency in the past, is, well, basically, if you've got 33 senators or 34 senators, and you're the president, you can do what you want. And so I think institutionally, what we saw was the Senate, which claims to be the world's greatest deliberative body, really abdicating its responsibility. So I think that is a long-term consequence. As for President Trump, you know, he's going to be unbound, I suppose, but he was never going to be bound anyway. And he was never going to be, or, you know, did I hope he would be removed? Yes. Mm. Did I ever believe he was going to be removed? No.
Yeah.
So therefore, to some extent, on Wednesday, we got confirmation of where we were always going when this started.
To be sure. I think, like you, it was the process that really horrified me. I knew what the result was going to be. But, you know, the absence of witnesses, the kind of disdain with which Senate Republicans are treated the whole process, suggests, you know, one of the things about the Clinton impeachment from 20 plus years ago is that senators took the process very seriously, even when they were dealing with charges that were an order of magnitude less serious than what Trump was facing.
Yes.
And they took their role as jurors seriously, even if they also said they weren't jurors, but they took the whole thing with the gravitas that a kind of impeachment deserves. Thinking about it, it's effect sort of both short-term and long-term. I mean, short-term, Trump's going to do what Trump's going to do. But comparing this to the other two, you know, impeachments, and if you want to throw in Nixon there as well, one of the effects that impeachment had was to sort of rebalance the power between the presidency and Congress. So if you look after Johnson's impeachment, Johnson continues to be who Johnson was after he's impeached, but he doesn't exercise the same kind of political authority that he did before he was impeached. And the presidents who come after him, you have three decades essentially of a relatively weak presidency compared to a relatively strong Congress. When Nixon resigns, I think likewise you have a rebalancing of power where Congress has more power in the late 70s and 80s than it, the trajectory. There was at least a minor recalibration there. With Clinton, it didn't happen. But I think in part it didn't happen because immediately after Clinton's impeachment was the 2000 election, which everyone, knows about that, the chaotic mess there, and obviously 9/11, which also then sort of reoriented any kind of reform movements.
Clinton was succeeded by a Republican.
Yes.
So, and the Republicans have demonstrated, actually, in fairness, both parties have demonstrated an ability and a willingness to give more power to somebody from their party than they will to the other. I mean, I think, I think a redress and a reformation is coming in terms of presidential power. And I think Republicans are going to find religion on circumscribing presidential power once it's a Democrat.
Yes.
And so maybe that reformation will come for the wrong reasons, but I think it's coming. So I think post-Trump, we're at an interesting moment. Post-Trump, we either have, we develop a new model of the presidency where it is a much more authoritarian institution, or there will be a kind of reform moment. And it remains to be seen which will happen. I think, again, Republicans may come to embrace limiting presidential power, possibly for the wrong motives, but it's the right thing to do. But it was, I think the impact of the Senate, I think the institutional impact on the Senate might be more long-lasting, and I think that's very interesting, because senators historically have always been institutionalists and taken a great deal of pride in that institution and its privileges and responsibilities, and they seem to have abdicated those in favor of partisan interests.
I think that's right.
With the exception of Mitt Romney. What do you think of Mitt Romney? Mitt Romney, I was stunned to learn he was in the history of all of this,
yes,
that he's the first senator to vote against his party in an impeachment trial.
Yes, but our sample size is 3.
So, yes, I understand.
And obviously in Johnson's impeachment, there were some weird things because it's unclear exactly what party Johnson was a part of because of the Union Party.
And had Nixon been impeached, we would have seen bipartisan.
Right. So I'm not sure.
Tried.
Yes, I think we would. I'm not sure our sample size. But I was also struck by Romney's stance and the ways in which, he gave a fairly, or I thought was a very articulate rationale for his vote. And it's been striking the way in which he has been cast aside by the Republican establishment, or I guess the Trump establishment, or which I guess are the same thing now, instantaneously. I mean, I think he's been sort of, you know, there are people calling for him to be removed from the Senate and other kinds of things that aren't going to happen. But, you know, the kind of hyper-partisanship that doesn't allow for dissent, even when the dissent doesn't matter. I mean, in this case, the dissent doesn't change the outcome of anything.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought the smart move for a while, and I'm surprised more Republicans didn't make this move, but it may be that it's not the smart move, would be for somebody to think, okay, I'm going to position myself for the post-Trump Republican Party and try to emerge from the wreckage relatively unscathed. Yeah. And that move would say, okay, say, you know, vote in favor of impeachment, because he wasn't going to be removed anyway. So I'm surprised. Mitt Romney has always been, had a weird relationship with Trump, so... And, you know, I immediately looked up his date of birth, thinking, okay, is he going to run in 2024? And I think the answer is yes, he's 70. And by
which
the
is a young man.
Yeah, by the standards of the current race, you know, that makes him younger than Bernie. And he would be younger in 2024 than Bernie and Biden are today.
Okay,
So and he seems to be pretty healthy.
Yes.
LDS lifestyle suits him.
Yes.
So he may, I think Romney's thinking, okay, what's the GOP post-Trump? Now, and that's going to be a very interesting question. And I think he's positioning himself to emerge from the wreckage, which I think is a smart move, but as well as the right thing to do. But
Think about him and his father are both from the sort of moderate wing of the Republican Party.
Which to a certain extent doesn't
exist anymore. he sort of exists by himself.
Do you think we'll have more impeachments in the future?
Well, so, I mean, one of the things that came up during the trial, and I'm putting trial in quotation marks or italics or something, because without witnesses, I think that was sort of the shame of the trial. Ken Starr said that we were having too many impeachments, which was, you know, given...
Pretty rich
coming from him. So on the one hand, it seems like we are going to have impeachment be used more often. On the other hand, it also seems like impeachment is a dead letter, right? Like that it's a purely political posturing. It has never resulted in a removal of a president from office, and is unlikely to.
I think Nixon's resignation was a result of an impending impeachment.
I've been rethinking that though in the past 72 hours. Right, that they, you know, the I guess the narrative we always tell about Nixon is Nixon would have been impeached, and so he resigned, you know, to leave office honorably without the punishing the country for an impeachment and removal. If looking back on the Johnson impeachment, looking now at the Clinton impeachment and the Trump impeachment, less convinced that was a done deal. That I previously thought.
Nixon must be rolling over in his grave thinking, I can't believe I had to resign.
I mean, exactly.
This guy's getting away with it. But it was a different environment then. I mean, I think Nixon was many things. Stupid was not one of them.
That's true.
He was able to count the votes. He knew he wasn't going to survive the trial. That the Republicans in the Senate weren't going to stand by him, and he had to go.
Yeah. Is the threshold for impeachment too high, or for removal too high?
Yes.
So what do you think the standard should be? Should it be 50 votes in the Senate? 51 votes in the Senate?
No, I mean, then we're... impeachment, it's like referenda. I think maybe 60%, 60 votes makes sense.
Okay.
I think a supermajority, but maybe not two-thirds, because two-thirds is a lot. 67
it's
is a lot.
It's very hard.
It's very hard to achieve that. And 51, the problem with 51 would be we would end up with a parliamentary system where essentially the president could be removed simply because the opposition party has a majority in the Senate. And we don't want it to be too easy either.
Because the impeachment process seems to actually work very well for, or at least moderately well for judges. I mean, and as much as many judges, you know, a dozen or more judges have been removed through the exact same process, including for things that are orders of magnitude less significant than anything Trump did.
Yeah.
But for the presidency, it just seems the stakes are too high for people to make.
Well, yes, but, you know, Trump is sui generis. He's So it's difficult to know, and this is going to be the question that confronts the Republicans in the next few years, the degree to which he can get away with it. So if you think about the Trump-like characters, like, was it Paul LePage in Maine? Was Paul his first name?
Yeah.
You know, who lost his re-election bid. People who act like Trump, even in the Republican Party, aren't succeeding as well as Trump does.
That's true.
You know, so Trump gets away with stuff that other people wouldn't. For whatever reason. I think there are there's a kind of constellation of reasons that explain that. And impeachment might be a case in point.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that you're thinking about the speech he gave yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, this is coded, all this.
And I was thinking about that in comparison to the speech that Bill Clinton gave at the end of his impeachment, where he Clinton apologized for his actions, for putting the country through the particular trauma of impeachment and distracting from the business of the people. You know, one can doubt how sincere Clinton was in any of that.
No, but he felt that he had to do it.
He felt he had to do it, and he was able to do it convincingly.
Yes.
And you know, I think there's just a sense, you know, also when you think about Nixon and then Ford's pardon of Nixon and the ways in which he talks about the long national nightmare being over and the sort of the political drama distracting from actual governance. You know, Trump's speech, if for those people who didn't get a chance to listen to it yesterday, was unhinged even by Trump standards. And it was a victory speech. And he describes it as you know, one of the notes that was sort of in the speech repeatedly was the American people beat the hoax put on by the other side. And the supposition being that if you supported impeachment, you were therefore not really American.
Yet, the majority of Americans supported
impeachment.
And in fact, supported removal. Well, first of all, he never takes the high road.
No.
I mean, the history of the, you know, we now have enough data to say that conclusively. He's never going to reach out in a bipartisan way. Secondly, these performances, I mean, unhinged was the word you used, are increasingly becoming more frequent, more unhinged, if one can talk about that in relative terms. I think he's in a cognitive decline. I'm not an expert in this, I have to confess, of course not, but that he, you know, there's something going on there cognitively that's a concern of mine, at least, and I think we're seeing that. You know, he's increasingly playing to a smaller and smaller base that he tells and that believes that they are America.
Yeah.
But that's not true.
Yeah, well, I think it's that second point. I mean, I'm with you. I think there might be something wrong with him, but I'm like, well, you can't diagnose it. But the fact that he was giving this speech and he was being rewarded by the people in the room and by the people on Fox News for saying things that were both false and, you know, really kind of out there in left field in some ways. You know, the fact that the feedback loop he's receiving both in the room and online and on TV tells him that he's brilliant is only going to sort of exacerbate these tendencies.
Yes, but I'd love to know what they say in the green room on Fox News or what they say in the Senate cloakroom when it's just them. You know, and there aren't Democrats around or critics around. Because on one hand, and I was talking to a taxi driver about this yesterday, we have a situation where if you were a Trump voter, let's say you're an Obama Trump voter, which I find fascinating and, you know, difficult to comprehend. Once you voted for this guy, and everybody tells you he's a racist, everybody tells you he's an idiot, everyone who's opposed to him, it makes it very difficult to walk that back. And so, therefore, they're not going to admit to you and me that they think he's impaired or that he's lost it or what have you, particularly given the power he still seems to have, that his senators are afraid of him, the GOP senators. They're afraid of a nickname. They're afraid of a mean tweet. Having said that, what do they say to each other? You occasionally get hints of this in the press, and you get hints of it from some senators who say, well, my Republican colleagues tell me when the television cameras are off, they think he's crazy or whatever. What do they say to each other? That's a part of this story I really want to know.
And then I think there's two ways that could spin out. I mean, one is that they see through the artifice and see that there's a what he's doing is deeply troubling, and all the other things we've mentioned, which I think has happened with previous presidents that were unusual. Although I don't think anyone's ever reached Trump's level of unusualness. You know, there were Republicans who were not sure about George W. Bush, and right. Sort of said, "Yeah, okay, we know he's got some things," and the other thing, you know, and likewise with Nixon, there was sort of the both spoken in private and unspoken sort of discourse within the parties about those guys. On the other hand, like the alternative reading is that this is becoming more of an authoritarian kind of regime, in which people are, even if they have these thoughts, are afraid to speak them in private because they're worried that it's going to get back to somebody and there'll be consequences. So I can imagine in a Fox green room during the George W. Bush administration, maybe some people doubting some of his choices and being able to articulate that in a private setting. I'm worried that we're actually in a place right now where those people might be afraid of articulating those same kinds of thoughts.
No, I mean, I...
You don't buy it?
No. I mean, everybody writes a book. These, you know, once they're free of the Trump administration, you know, so Bolton's writing a book, you know, they talk to the press. I mean, this is a leaky, incompetent administration.
Oh, to be sure. Yes.
And the briefing against them is pretty significant. So, you know, when you said there might be the consequence they seem to be afraid of is electorally.
Mm.
That Trump is going to either encourage somebody to primary them and run against them, or that Trump is going to attack them and this will undermine their support.
Mm.
So I think there is a political problem to this, and I think they're afraid of consequences. The implication of your statement was the kind of consequences of living in an authoritarian state. I think he has authoritarian tendencies. Basically, you get mocked if you break with order. Like, you know, so Romney is getting abused on social media. That's not insignificant. It's, you know, he's not being imprisoned.
Oh, to be sure. This is authoritarianism light.
Yeah. I think we're not there. And I say we're not there yet. And one shouldn't be complacent. I mean, some of the tenets, we've seen things in the past 3 years that were unimaginable 6 years ago.
Yes.
So I wouldn't want to be complacent about that. But I'd love to know what they say to each other.
All right. Maybe we will find out when they write their memoirs in 10 years.
Yeah, but I don't know how, I'm disappointed in the GOP senators, but I'm really surprised because they're senators that some of them didn't take a longer view.
Mm. I think the fact that Romney doesn't up for election for another 4 years.
And he's running in Utah, where he's a very popular and influential person from a popular and influential family. And
he's got more money than he needs, and so he's not dependent on donors to the same extent. But it's weird who people I'm cheering for now that five years ago I would not have been. The fact that I'm thinking in favor about Bolton and Romney suggests we're in a very
good
place. And
that they've been cast out of the Republican establishment.
Yes, when they were the Republican establishment, yes.
Well, I mean, I probably even said this on the podcast before, and you know, I certainly supported President Obama and voted for him twice, but, you know, had Romney won in 2012, we'd be coming up to the end of the second Romney term, we'd probably be in a better place.
That's a weird counterfactual. You're probably right. Unfortunately. All right, time for last drops. What you got?
Well, David Silkenat was nominated for this Lincoln Prize. I want to endorse a podcast. It's called AmeriCast.
AmeriCast.
It's just started on the BBC. It's hosted by Emily Maitlis and John Sobel. Emily Maitlis, many of you will know, is the one who conducted the very good interview of Prince Andrew about the Jeffrey Epstein matter, his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein a month or so ago. Mm-hmm. And John Sobel's the BBC's guy in Washington. I have to confess, I'm quite critical to the point of intolerance of British media coverage of the United States, which I often find patronizing and insulting and often wrong. But this is a very good podcast. These two really understand. you know, understand America. It's entertaining. They're great to listen to. There've only been two episodes so far, one on the caucuses and one on the impeachment. But as a start, it augurs really well. John Sobel wrote a really interesting book a couple of years ago called If Only They Don't Speak English, reflecting on his time in the United States to that point. And the theme of that was very interesting. I heard him speak about it. He said, you know, one of the problems that British people have in approaching the United States is because we share a language and there's sort of superficial similarities, we don't treat it as we, that is the British in this context, don't treat it as a foreign country the way we should. If they spoke a different language, we would.
Yes.
And we try to understand it in those terms, but instead we think we understand it and we misunderstand it fundamentally. He's a very, very, well, they're both very, very good journalists and very interesting commentators. So, Americast.
Okay, great.
Yeah, what about you, Dan?
So I was walking through the Crystal McMillan building yesterday. For those of you who aren't familiar with the geography of campus, that's connected to the old medical school where the history department is located. And there was a table set up by votefromabroad.org, which is an organization, well, it's actually a branch of, I guess, Democrats Abroad, but they were doing this to encourage people, Americans, to register to vote from overseas and to make it easy to vote overseas. And voting overseas is can be slightly tricky. You guys are planning ahead in a way, maybe more so than if you are on the ground in the States, but they seem to be doing good work. And so they're votefromabroad.org. So if you're an American listening to this from outside the United States, make sure you register in time to vote in the next election.
Have you used them? Because I've used them in the past.
I have not used them. I use the federal government has a system of doing things which I think is probably more complicated than votefromabroad.org.
It takes you right. I mean, I've used it. It's very simple to use. And it takes you to your state, the appropriate state for you to vote in the locality, and lets you know what you need to do. You fill out the paperwork online. It produces a PDF. Often you have to sign it and print it off, sign it, and mail it. But it's very easy to use. I would endorse your last drop.
Okay. Votefromabroad.org. Everyone registered to vote. It's very important. Right.
Excellent.
Next time.
Cheers. Cheers. David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.